This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to the studio, Stu Fenton. Welcome, sir.
Hello.
It's been a while, but great to have you back. And joining us on the line is Luke Williams. He's a journalist who wrote an article titled Life as a Crystal Meth Addict, published in the Saturday paper only last week. Luke, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Luke, takes a lot of guts to write an article as raw as this. You didn't hold back, but can I ask why you wanted to go gonzo and embed yourself amongst those who were clearly addicted to write an article and then find yourself in this predicament?
Well, because nearly everybody I knew in Melbourne had succumbed to the drug in one way or another, and I wanted to find out why. But I also knew that there was a group of people who took the drug in what I thought was safe levels and it didn't affect them. And I was a little, cynical about some of the media reporting around it and thought that it was perhaps a little hysterical and maybe just a way of picking on the poor and picking on the underclass, which was essentially who I moved in with, given that they were really just working class dropouts. So I wanted to get in amongst it. I thought that there might be a book in it. And whilst I was in amongst it, I took some of it and slowly got addicted, as you've already alluded to.
How did you identify the people to be your subjects? How did you know them?
I just looked up my Facebook friends.
Right. I'm looking for a crystal addict. Anyone there?
Sorry?
Nothing. You probably have hundreds of Facebook friends.
Well, no, because I hang out with sort of rough people. That's the way I like it. And I've known these people for a long time, and they haven't been meth addicts for very long, but they've been drug users for a long time. And I wanted to see how they actually slipped into, as the research has shown, the crystal meth increases come amongst existing drug users. And I wanted to see how that happened. Essentially, they were, trucky speed users, I guess you could call it. So there were people I already knew, there were people I already lived with, and there were people that trusted me and knew that they could just be themselves around me, and it would make a good story. I didn't think it would be quite this good, though.
Well, yeah.
Stu,
so to speak.
Yeah, Stu here in the studio. Was it similar for you in that you just had a circle of friends who happened to be using, or how were you exposed to crystal in the first instance?
You mean
Years and years ago, through the gay scene, I was, but with this particular group of people who I moved in, who are not gay people, they were straight men and straight-ish men, who I've known for a while. When I used it around them, it was a totally different experience to the crystal that I'd used years and years ago, because it's much stronger now because people have worked out how to make it themselves. So it totally blew me away. And when I first took it, I thought, oh, this is good. I can understand why people take it now, because it's a great drug and I can do things and I feel so good about myself and I feel like I've achieved something when I take it. And I guess I came to suspect that, yes, we heard about homicides and robberies and people going psychotic, but what I kind of thought was happening was that it was being scapegoated as a kind of a cure-all evil, or rather than looking at these things as an aspect of society or an aspect of human behaviour, that the media were kind of using drugs as a bit of a kind of evil potion that's taking over. But I've changed my view on that, in that I think that it is an evil drug, and it makes perfectly good people evil and evil people just off the planet horrible, like killing babies in Bendigo and that kind of thing.
Stu Fenton, Luke alluded to drugs. And in his article, he talks about people who smoke pot and then graduating, if you like, to crystal meth. Back in our day, it might have been ecstasy and graduating to crystal. Is this a regular pattern?
Well,
this sort of graduating from one to crystal. Is crystal the last bastion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it differs between different cultures and different demographics, I guess. You know, I work in a rehab where there's loads of different people, but generally it does seem that most people start out on things like pot and alcohol, or alcohol first, then pot, and slowly work their way through. And I think crystal meth either might be the definitely, you know, up there with heroin, but some people are doing crystal meth and heroin together. You know, it's not that common, but I'd say that's probably one pit stop along from crystal meth. But they're all, you know, in the end, when you get to that level of subhuman living, it's all pretty much the same.
Luke, your use started out what I'd probably describe as social.
Mm.
Would you describe it as that?
Yes, and I would say it very quickly descended into subhuman. I think I've never heard that expression for it, but I think that sums it up beautifully, in that you do just feel like an animal after a while. But yes, it was social, and you do feel an immediate bond with people that you're taking it with, regardless of whether you would normally have a bond with them or not. And the reason that I actually slipped into it is because I slowly became psychotic, and I was losing track of how much I was actually using, which I guess is what people say when they talk about it being psychologically addictive. But I just thought that meant it's because you feel miserable when you're off it. But it's not that you feel miserable. You feel confused and paranoid, and then you take some and you go, oh, now I'm crystal clear, so to speak. And so that's how you get hooked into it, and that's how your brain gets tricked into believing that it's the right thing for you, because when you're off it, you feel confused and ratty, and then you go, oh, I'm clear again. Okay, that's fine. Okay, maybe crystal meth's doing something good for me then.
Stu, there's lots of ways to take crystal, and smoking is one, and ingesting it or snorting it is another, and then ultimately, I guess, injecting it. There seems to be a clear pattern of progression in regards to people that start out maybe ingesting it or smoking it. If they stay with it long enough, they end up injecting it.
Yeah, it's actually not always the case. I mean, the thing that I find really interesting working with a lot of heterosexual men and women is that many people, especially, you know, in Victoria, getting stuck on smoking it. And I don't know if that's because a lot of the people that I'm working with are between sort of the ages of 20 and 35, whether it's only because they just haven't progressed that far yet. You know, what I generally see is the people who are using it intravenously, not on the gay scene, well, that it generally doesn't happen so often with the heterosexual community. You know,
you mean the sexualization of taking the drug?
Well, that's also a much more common thing, I think, with the gay community. You know, like what I noticed even 10 to 14 years ago is that it was very common in the gay community to inject speed, which then transformed into injecting crystal meth. I think it also, there became that culture too of mixing it up with GHB and all the sexual behaviour that goes along with it. What I notice with a lot of, well, actually it's becoming quite common in younger heterosexual demographics now to mix GHB and crystal meth as well. But it's not always, especially with the males, not always about sex. You know, they like, in fact, heterosexual males doing crystal meth generally are more often likely to go out and commit crime because it gives them confidence and they get a high and a hit off it and they enjoy doing that. However, you know, like there is actually quite a lot of men and women too who are now using it to be sexual, but that's not always injecting. It's also, it's a lot of it is still just smoking it.
Luke, in your, sorry, Andrew.
That's right. No, I was going to say, Luke, how much fucking happens when a group of gay guys get together on crystal?
I was using with straight men, so it's not very much other than them watching dull pornos from the 1980s over and over again, and then glancing over at me like, you know, I wonder if I could, you know, And most of the time it was just talking and talking and talking.
But you also said, though, that in your earlier years you did use it a little bit with friends.
I did, but I never used it in a sexual...
Okay.
I didn't. I understand people do. I find that I don't feel like it when I'm on it, and I warn people when I'm with them if that's the idea, when they pull some out, that I'm likely just to talk their ear off and not feel like it. Often I feel like it the next day, but it's all in my head. It doesn't function downstairs. And I think a lot of people find that, and I think sex is interesting enough and good enough and fun enough anyway that you don't need to spice it up, if you like, with crystal meth. And I find that it tends to leave guys in very predictable sort of fantasy mode where they're constantly wanting to break up to the next exciting dirty taboo, and it takes the love and the intimacy and the affection out of it. It's all about being dirty and being gruff and rough. And
you know, Stu, that's exactly the attraction that it is for many.
Yeah, definitely on the gay scene. I don't know if that's changing a little bit now, but I mean, my understanding is that's still basically what I, you know, when I'm dealing with gay men coming in, that's generally what I still hear for sure.
This sexualisation of crystal indicates why we're seeing such a huge spike in the connection between the use of it and HIV infections. But it's not helped by the likes of apps and people, as I said to Andrew before, now advertising where to get drugs on these apps. It's not just advertising sex, it's advertising where to get your drugs.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the big issues that comes up, not just like in some of the support groups that I'm involved with. You know, one of the first steps that we take is getting people who are addicted to remove the apps and to delete all these sorts of programs so that they don't have that easy access to it. You know, back in my day, like 12 years ago, it was more like take the dealer's numbers out of your phones. But now the apps like Grindr and everything are just chock-a-block with people quite overtly advertising it and going after you with it. And that's the way that perhaps some people are actually luring people in to having sex is by offering it. So, you know, it's a very hard thing to get rid of. And the other problem is that people can, even if they get rid of these apps, they pull them back on straight away if they need to, if they're triggered.
You're with Dean Beck and Andrew the Apprentice. Our guests are Stu Fenton. He is in the studio. On the phone is Luke Williams, the author of an article titled Life as a Crystal Meth Addict. It's in the Saturday paper. Luke, is the Saturday paper in print or only online?
It is in print.
Right.
At all good news agents.
There you go.
It's published by Black Ink, who also do the monthly and quarterly essay.
Ah.
You can look at that online as well, and there's some interesting comments online, actually, of people who are users who are saying that I've kind of shown too much of the bad side of the use and I need to write an article about... Well, I guess they're sort of saying I need to write an article about the joys and the virtues of the drug because many people use it safely.
Well, you did allude to quite a number of the euphoric effects. And, Stu, we know that these are caused by an absolute flood of dopamine, but this has a counter effect as well.
Well, I mean, just reading Luke's article, yeah, I mean, it seems there that what they're saying is that it's a contributor to psychosis. But I think, you know, some of the worst parts of that too is that, you know, when you release the, such a massive amount of dopamine in a short space of time, and this is especially true for binge users, is that, you know, there's nothing left for you to use for what you would normally want to use as a normal human being. So then you go through this hideous withdrawal, which takes 6 to 8 days.
Which is the come down that people talk of.
Absolutely, the come down where people generally just want to sleep and not be social and, you know, not connect with anyone, but also feel kind of nauseous and
can that lead to
irritable.
Depression?
Absolutely, yeah. I think especially when you're using this on a daily basis or even if you're using it as a binge user, you're going to deplete those levels so much that you're going to at least feel like you're depressed or be depressed. And I think I read an article recently too that suggested they don't know the really long-term effects of meth use in terms of depression and whether, you know, some of the serotonin and dopamine can be replenished fully when it needs to. And I think this is something that hits people once they get into rehab after a fairly long period of using, is the question in like, can I ever really be happy again? You know, some people think that's because they've used the drug for so long and they're just not accustomed to living life on life's terms. But I think there's also the added question, you know, are those different dopamine and serotonin levels ever going to come right back up to their normal level?
Luke, have you noticed anything yourself in either physically or psychologically since you've undertook this, let's call it an experiment?
Well, I'm definitely not as good looking now that I'm not taking it anymore, so it's good that it's brought me back to reality. I mean, that's one thing it gives you, is it gives you a heightened sense of self, and it, to me, that's a form of paranoia.
Yep.
It has. I will talk to that, but in terms of the dopamine and the serotonin, Dr. Rebecca McKitten in the article talks about the fact that excessive dopamine is your reward center, but excessive dopamine is also what happens in the brain of someone who's got paranoid schizophrenia. When there's excessive dopamine, that causes a drop in the serotonin levels. Your serotonin levels are your good mood chemical, and it also causes an increase in your noradrenaline levels, which are related to your anxiety and your fight or flight response. So what actually happens is you have the excessive dopamine, which is causing paranoia, like if you've got paranoid schizophrenia. In a psychotic episode, the drop in serotonin levels is what causes the depression, and then the increase in the noradrenaline levels is what leaves you feeling anxious, and is what perhaps leads to violence in many people. I don't think I use it for a long enough period for it to have a lasting effect. And I have managed to recover and find happiness, but not in the same pleasure excitement way, but more in a, my life is more meaningful now. It feels more authentic. I'm helping people. I'm doing things that are artistic. I feel more, as I said, my life is more meaningful, even though it's not as exciting. But the people who are using it over long periods of time, I really do worry about how they would ever, even on that biochemical level, find happiness again, let alone the fact that they've dug themselves in such a big hole. I wonder how they're ever going to get themselves
Stu,
out of it.
This is where you do a lot of work in helping people rebuild their lives. And Luke is right to some extent that, you know, it's not just the dopamine. We're talking about financial ruin, loss of friendship circles, loss of family sometimes, sometimes jail for people. Can they, at this bottom of the pit state, rebuild their lives and find happiness and find a complete wholeness again?
Yeah, I mean, I would say yes to that, and I say that from personal experience. You know, I'm a recovering addict, but I also work, all my work pretty much is with recovering crystal meth addicts, and I see people at all different stages of that recovery process. You know, I would say for quite big chunks of my recovery, you know, I experienced flatness, maybe, you know, not clinical depression, but areas of depression, and which I often thought of was perhaps contributed to by my drug use. But I, you know, like I feel quite happy in my life today, and, you know, I have great moments of joy, and also the people that I mentor and, you know, the clients that I work with, I have seen this happen for them as well, you know, and there are different ways that people go about that, you know, like I work in both harm reduction as well as abstinence, and, you know, I actually believe, and it's just a personal opinion, that people have perhaps abstinence is a much trickier sort of state to achieve because it requires a great deal of work and a bit of sacrifice. But especially in 12-step programs, what they offer you is different strategies to rebuild yourself financially and to rebuild yourself emotionally, spiritually, mentally, in all those different ways. And not only that, you know, by going to those meetings and being around those people, you also hear how people ahead of you have recovered in that way too. And that's how I learned a lot of how to recover in my life, you know, from, you know, financial disaster as well as you know, not knowing my emotions or being how to be a functional or emotionally functional person in the world. You know, I had to relearn all that, and some of it I just had to learn from scratch. But I definitely believe it's possible.
To get onto that journey, what was your personal moment of self-realization that something needed to change at the time?
For myself?
Yeah.
I think, well, it's pretty obvious for me. It's that I was one of the crystal meth addicts that experienced drug-induced psychosis. And up until that point, I'd used a lot of ecstasy, party drugs, and GHB. And, you know, they had all started to stop working for me as well, and, you know, different things were happening. But nothing that ever made me want to do anything quite radical. But, you know, within a couple of years of using crystal meth, I was having psychotic experiences. And not everyone does on crystal meth. You know, I've met lots of people who never developed psychosis, but I did. And the psychosis was so debilitating, you know, like, I won't go into some of the things that happened, but they involve police, and they involve being, you know, hospitalized. They involve psych ward admissions. And, you know, for me, I just had come from a great family who really cared about me, and I had studied and got a career, and I could just see myself putting it down the toilet very quickly. And that was probably my reality, was the time I ended up in the psych ward and, yeah, decided this is it. I need to do something radical now.
And, Luke, within your three-month period, you found yourself homeless a couple of times under threats of lots of violence, and that was your...
And your own level of psychosis.
And your own level of psychosis. And that was your self-realization, I understand?
Yeah, well, I mean, I knew I was there for a project, but I got so involved in taking the drug, and I honestly, there was a period there where I was taking it so much that I've lost track of how much, even the time period of it, and I was going in and out of psychosis. And anyone who has been in psychosis will know that a psychotic episode is accompanied by blackouts. So there was a period there where I was coming in and out of believing mainly that people were trying to kill me, and that there was a secret plot that was going on. At one stage, I looked in the mirror and saw how terrible I looked, and thought that people were plotting to poison me, and rang my dad and told him I knew he was in on it, and I knew about this and knew about all this other stuff. And it was very scary because it felt like it was really happening.
But yeah, very real, very true in your experience.
Very real, and then you feel very ashamed of it when you come out of it. And when you're in the midst of a binge, the only way of actually clearing your mind is to take more meth.
Is there a realization afterwards that what you were experiencing as reality was actually not reality? Is there a post?
Yes, definitely. Right. You come in and out of it. And in fact, I would come in and out of it whilst I was in it.
Right.
I would have moments of going, oh, no, that's just because of that. And, oh, sorry, everyone.
Right.
And
was yours like that, Stu?
No, I mean, well, a little bit, but mostly once I went psychotic, that was it. I was just mad person, and for me, I couldn't ever go back and go, oh, you know, maybe this isn't happening. I needed to be put down like an elephant, you know, like I needed to take really heavy duty sleeping tablets, and it was usually not me administering them, because I thought that if I were to take sleeping tablets, someone would kill me in my sleep. So it was usually other people either sneaking them into my drinks to try and put me down,
Or the hospital staff.
Or the hospital staff with liquid Valium, exactly.
Right. So it's something that I have witnessed, and that thing about it being real for the person experiencing it, to witness as a person who stone cold sober, was very, very challenging to see a friend totally... In a different world, in a different reality. But it was important for me to acknowledge where they were at without making them wrong in that space and sort of adding to it. But it's, you know, I had to sit with someone for 3.5 hours whilst they lay in the bottom of their shower with the water running and running cold, because they were washing their blood.
Yes, well, I mean, this is the tricky part about it, and, you know, it's interesting what you say. I discovered years later that you know, if someone is psychotic, it is important not to tell them that, you know, that's not happening.
Yeah, don't arc up against it. Just sit with them and go with it.
Exactly. Yeah, because
and keep them safe.
That's only likely to make them more agitated, because they believe 300% what's happening is happening. And if you tell them it's not, they're going to get even more distressed. Yeah. But, you know, of course, in certain situations, if they're going to catch, you know, pneumonia or something like that, you've got to sort of sneakily do stuff.
I was more worried about the bloody water that was building up on the floor, because he was lying on the plug hole and the water kept building up and it was flowing out into the hallway. Get off the plug.
But maybe a wally with water.
Exactly. I quietly just took myself into another room and I phoned a friend who was a counsellor with Living Positive Victoria, and I asked what to do in the scenario that I found myself in. And he advised me that there were only two options, either to get him to a hospital or to call an ambulance. And so after about 2 or 3.5 hours, I managed to get him out of the shower, get him on bed, and I said to him, "Now, I'm just telling you, I have two options. This is what I'm going to do." And with that, he snapped out of it and was good as gold.
Mm.
But and I guess, Luke, as you indicated before, you would find yourself out of it or back in it, back in reality, and then questioning what was going on previously.
Yeah, and at times I would get to what I thought was the nut of it. Like I would realise, oh, that's like something, because I was picked on and everything at school, I'd go, oh, no, it's just from that.
Right.
And I'd tear up about it and I'd let it go.
Yeah.
And so when that first started happening, I thought that meth was helping me come to terms with past traumas. But in retrospect, I think it was just, I feel like I've kind of dealt with this stuff and moved on from it. And there was actually traumas that I thought I was getting out of my system, which in fact I'd never actually specifically happened to me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You're inventing things.
I was inventing things and then thinking meth was helping me get these traumas out of my system. But in reality, as much as I went through bad stuff in high school, as unfortunately a lot of us has, I have already taken this stuff in my stride, and I have, you know, like it's a scar that I carry, but I've moved on and I function I was sitting around dwelling on these things in a way that wasn't very helpful, which I think happens when we all come down, all of us who have used drugs, we all come down on drugs. We dwell on things that we thought we'd dealt with or we'd moved on from.
It fucks with your head.
It does.
You're listening to Hide and Seek on 294.9. Dean Beck and Andrew, The Apprentice, are with you. Our guest in the studio is Stu Fenton, who is a Gestalt therapist and a psychotherapist
and drug and alcohol counsellor.
There you go. That's what he is. And on the line we have Luke Williams, and he's a journalist. And are you a lawyer as well, Luke?
I am a lawyer.
I'm sorry.
I was a lawyer just before I started this project.
Yeah, well, that'd be enough to send anyone to Crystal, I reckon.
Yeah, I was going to put it at the end of the story and, you know, at least I'm not working as a lawyer anymore. It really is awful being a lawyer.
Luke,
don't believe the hype.
You reached out to your parents, who were good enough to bundle you up and take you back home to clean up and iron out.
Yeah.
How are they doing?
They're good. They were really upset at the time because I was...
Well, you'd told them where to go in no uncertain terms.
Well, I left messages 7 or 8 times on their phone in the middle of the night, being really awful, really horrible to them.
Had you briefed them before?
That you were going in as an exercise?
Yeah.
No, I hadn't.
Well, that might have helped.
Well, because they would have said, don't do it.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, well, most people were pretty cynical. In fact, people who knew me just thought that I was lying about going in there as a project, because they know that it's the kind of thing that I have done anyway in the past.
It is a little extreme.
Well, I can't stand all these journalists who are very middle class and write about very middle class things, and it seems very timid and tame, and I wanted to really get in there and tell a story about a side of our culture that doesn't get told very often, which is always full of excitement and full of drama and full of characters, and I thought was very misunderstood. But I'm going to have to call it as I see it and saying that it's parts of the underclass are very unpleasant and it's not very nice. And I felt like I felt like it was a bit exploitative in the end, like I was a bit of a tosser going in, you know, like those wankers who go to India for their big revelation or something when it's just appalling poverty everywhere.
To find enlightenment.
Pardon?
To find enlightenment.
Yeah, that's right. Hmm. And these are actually people's lives and they are awful and these people did actually have kids and meth is truly repulsive. And actually, Stu, I wanted to ask you, given your experience, about whether there is actually a safe level of use with meth. Is there?
Oh, I think that's a really difficult question. I mean, I heard recently there's a documentary out and, you know, most of the I don't know which one it was, but it was one that showed many different kinds of people using it. And then there was a couple that had been intravenously using it for many, many years and that they were still functioning. But by the descriptions, the person who told me about it gave, you know, they didn't really look that healthy and, you know, they were very vague and stuff like that.
There are degrees of functioning too, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And I think the other thing that's tricky with this is that, you know, there's a lot of people, I think, out there in their 20s, which I always think is the kind of, you know, potentially fun years of drug taking and meth taking, where the negatives aren't really happening yet. So there's going to be a lot of people out there saying, yes, we can use meth functionally. I can use this and still function in my job. But what I see, you know, in the support groups that I've run and attended and also with all the clients that I deal with is that the point where people start coming in with problems with crystal meth is more often post 35, 40 and 50, you know. So there'll be people telling you that meth is a drug that you can use functionally, but I guess my core belief is that any drug is going to turn on you in the end in some way.
Stu, what's your and Luke was talking about, you know, calling up his parents in at all hours of the day and night. What would be your suggestion to, say, Luke's parents about how to deal with Luke at the time?
Well, that's interesting because I just did a sit-down counselling session with a family up in the country just a few days ago, and so I know exactly what I'd say because I've just done it.
You've done a few.
Yeah, but I mean, basically it's, I mean, I don't know Luke's scenario so much, but in a different kind of scenario, let's say the child or the son or daughter is using crystal meth and they're not turning up to work and they're abusing the family and they're taking the family for granted and expecting stuff and borrowing the family car, you know, all these sorts of things that meth users do to their families. I mean, my suggestions are basically you cannot enable them, you cannot give them anything anymore, you need to close ranks, you need to be a unified family unit. And say to that person, we want you to know that we love you and we care about you, but we're not going to enable you in your addiction. We're going to suggest that you go off to rehab. We've got the details and the brochures of four different options here for you. And the moment you say, I'm ready, you hold up the white flag and say, I surrender, we will do everything to get you into detox and into that treatment facility. But until that time, we are going to just
tough love.
Yes, tough, firm but fair, tough love.
And that holds not just for the for family, whatever that family may be, whether it's social network or genetic family.
Absolutely, because a lot of these support groups too are family and friends of, and I ran a support group up in Sydney for a number of years where there were, you know, loads of people from the gay community coming in saying, my flatmate is doing this or my girlfriend, you know, is doing this if it was another girl. And, you know, definitely it applies to any, whatever the family is.
Luke, you say in your article that empathy is one of the first qualities to go with an ICE addict, and it's followed by the ability to distinguish what is right and what is wrong, what is true and what is not, is also next on the list to go. These qualities of things that we basically see as our fundamental framework as human beings, they call to our value system. and what we do is become inauthentic to our true values.
Yes, and I think we become very much like animals when we use it and we go down that path. It strikes me with psychosis, and I've got family members who have got schizophrenia as well, that when they're in the psychotic episode, it becomes very childlike, and you think the whole world revolves around you and you're unable to realize you're doing harm. And with some of these people who were coming in and out of psychosis, which I only realized because they weren't verbalizing it, but I realized after a while that's what they were sitting there having mini psychotic episodes. They weren't realizing that they were neglecting their children. And then one of the main curiosities that I had about meth users was their compulsive lying, and whether the lying was manipulative, whether that they were believing their own lies, whether it was just a case of pure self-deception. I think in a way meth users become a bit like vampires, and there's lots of parallels in certainly the way they look, their lifestyle. They stay inside all the time, they sit up all night. They have human-like qualities, but ultimately they're ruled by this hunger, and there's a manipulation of social interaction to get there and get their fix in a way.
Luke Williams, I want to thank you for reaching out to us and sharing your article with me, firstly, and for being willing to come on air and discuss it further. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a really good conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Luke.
And you can read Luke's article at the Saturday Paper. Just check out one of my tweets, Dean Beck on Air, or Hide and Seek Joy?
Hide Seek on Air.
No, that's not it.
Hide Seek on Joy.
Thank you. On Twitter, and there's a link to that. And we'll put a link on the Hide and Seek page as well.
That's right.
Stu is still with us.
And Stu, you've got a new website in dealing with addiction.
Yeah, I've still got my old one, stufenton.com.au, which is specifically for gay men and their issues, but I've decided to also...
I don't think there's a website big enough for that, Stu.
Well, this second website is beyondaddiction.net.au, and that one is solely for addiction, but it's not just counselling and psychotherapy. It's also referral and to support families, friends, as well as addicts, with a specific area also on the website for ICE, but to support and help anyone who needs help in this area.
As you said before, that you know, having those referral pathways is important for those surrounding the users of ICE.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I was mentioning to you before, like, the services in Victoria at the moment and the reason for the inquiry that they're having and all those different studies is that the resources in Victoria are 20% less than what they are in New South Wales at the moment. It takes between 4 and 6 months to get into most rehabs in Victoria. It's a real shit fight to get into detoxes here. So that's why I set up the referrals and directions section of my website, so that anyone who thinks I don't have enough money for rehab, or which rehab do I choose, or why does it take so long to get in there, I'm happy and willing to support people and answer all those questions so that I can streamline the process for people and it's not so overwhelming or scary.
Stu Fenton, thank you so much for coming in tonight.
Thank you.
Great to have you back.
It's been a joy.
BeyondAddiction.net.au. You are with Dean Beck and The Apprentice. Thanks for joining us this evening. Until next time, keep well. Take care.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.